Ability amplitudes.
Okay,
Take it away, Bill.
Thanks. I hope you can hear me all right. So I decided to talk about this subject because, I mean, many of us use complex probability amplitudes every day in our research. Not all of us, but many of us do. It's a pretty basic question. And I phrase the question this way: why does nature like complex probability amplitudes? To make it clear that I'm not asking the question, why do we use complex probability amplitudes? I know why we use them, because they work, okay? They just work. Empirically, you get these various facts, and you can explain them by complex probability amplitude. What I'm wondering, though, is what gave nature the idea to build itself in this way, that complex probability amplitudes are the way things work. In other words, I'm asking for a deeper understanding of quantum theory. One possible response to that question is, maybe there is no deeper understanding. Maybe this is the bottom of, this is where it ends. Okay, this is the way the world is. Okay, nothing more to be understood. And that is conceivable. My hypothesis is that that's not the case, and that there is more to be understood. Let me just sort of get into it with, just where do complex probability amplitudes come up? So here's just one really classic example. There comes a single photon, and this is a regular beam splitter, 50-50 symmetric beam splitter. These are mirrors here. There's another 50-50 beam splitter there. And the simple question is, what's the probability that that photon will land in this detector or that detector? There's a straightforward way to compute it, and the straightforward way would give you 50-50. If you ask anyone on the street, what's the probability, they're going to tell you 50-50. But that's not correct. I mean, if you set this up all right, line everything upright, you can make it so 100% of the photons land in that detector. Okay, and why is that? Well, we have this quantum mechanical, you can explain it with classical waves, but that's not what I want to talk about, because this is a single photon I'm talking about. It's not a classical wave. So how do we compute the probabilities for the single photon? So the deal is, you don't just add up the probabilities, like in trying to figure out what's the probability of landing in that detector. You don't just add up the probabilities of the different paths for getting there, rather you add up the probability amplitudes for getting there. Okay, and the way you get the probability amplitudes is take square roots of probability. So the amplitude for passing through this beam splitter is a square root of a half. The probability is a half, but the probability amplitude is a square root of a half. And then the probability of bouncing off this beam splitter has to be different from this by a factor of I, so it's I over root 2. You get some inconsistencies if you don't throw in a factor of I. So then there are two possible ways to land in that top detector. You can take this lower path, in which case you get a factor of 1 over root 2 for going through that guy, and another factor of 1 over root 2 for going through that guy, and the product of those is a half, which is up there, that's the half, the probability amplitude of going the taking the upper path is you have an I over root 2 times, and there's another reflection there, so it's another factor of I over root 2. Oh, fantastic, that's what I'm talking about. Okay, and then that product is, this is good. This is a good pointer.
Now you're talking.
Yeah. Okay, this is going to be a good conference because we have a good pointer. So the product of those two guys is negative a half. And so you have these two different paths. This is the amplitude. If I said probability, I'm wrong. It's probability amplitude of going that path, probability amplitude of going this path. Add up those amplitudes, you get zero. Then you square zero to get the probability of landing in this detector, but zero squared is zero. So the probability of landing in this detector is zero. Okay, and then similarly, you get this. There are two ways to go to this detector. Each one has an amplitude of I over 2. You add those together, and you get I, and the magnitude squared of I is 1, so the probability of landing there is 1. Okay, so in this way, we get the correct answer by using these square roots of probability, these imaginary square roots of probability, or complex square roots of probability. By the way, please feel free to interrupt at any time about anything. This is supposed to be really, really informal. And I am going to try to stick to this idea of just talking for half an hour and then allowing half an hour of discussion. I think that's a great idea. I hope this works.
But how do they do this experiment?
Sorry?
They do this experiment.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Experimentally,
you can do this. You have to line everything up really right, okay, to make it work like this, but you can certainly do this. Yeah. 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 It's a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. You just have to, yeah, just line it up real, real good. Yeah. Okay. So, Mike, and of course, this idea of adding up complex probability amplitudes is not just for photons, it's for everything. Okay, this is how we do all of quantum theory. Okay, it's all based on these square roots of probability that are complex. And so, my question to nature is, why do we have to work with square roots of probability? Okay, so some deeper, I mean, think about explaining this to any 19th century physics. You say, here's how we compute probabilities.
Yes,
we take these complex numbers, which are probability amplitudes, we add them up, and then at the end, we take the absolute value squared. That's how we get probabilities. They would think you're crazy. I can't think of anyone in the 19th century who would not think that's crazy. Because the way you compute probabilities is you say, what are all the different ways that something can happen? What's the probability of each of those things happening? And you add up those probabilities to get the probability of the big thing happening. I mean, that's the way you normally compute probabilities. That's not at all how we do it here. I just really want to emphasize how weird quantum mechanics is, okay? It's just we're computing probabilities, but in a way that we would never compute probabilities before the 20th century. Yeah.
People know Bayes' interference back then?
They certainly knew that. They certainly knew that. That's right. They would not have had any problem with that experiment with beams of light. Yeah. That could understand. It's just the computation of probabilities that I want to focus on. That because we are talking about there a single photon landing in one detector or the other. Why does that photon land there? That's just really weird. And there are other cases, of course, where there's not such a clear classical analog. Yes, in this case, it is true. You can come up with a nice thing, which certainly was well known.
So if I may, again, take you on the experimental path.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do this experiment, not with single photon, but just with the photon source,
right.
It's not going to be the right answer. It's not going to be only on the...
Oh, it will be. It will be if you really set it up right. It really will do that. Now, of course, if you're using incoherent light, yeah, I'm talking about using a laser. Okay, I'm talking about using a long coherence length laser.
Single wavelength.
Yeah, single wavelength, right, and with a decent coherence length. Okay, so. Oh yeah, if you do it with a light bulb or
No. With a laser.
Oh yeah. Okay. This is definitely the idealization version, but we can do it.
So I think what we're getting at is two different mysteries here. There's the mystery of why is there probability in the first place? Why does the intensity of a wave only give probabilities of events? But then the other mystery I think you're getting at is, why is it that this wave, unlike EM waves, has to be complex? We think with EM waves, we at least have the option of saying, well, we really mean real part of e to the I kx minus omega.
Sure.
Here we don't get to do that.
Right, right. I mean, we could do it, but it'd feel artificial.
So we wouldn't get the right answer if we only took the real part of that.
Yeah, unless you just sort of artificially separate the real and imaginary parts and just... But the natural thing is complex. And also, I really want to emphasize that it's probabilities we're computing. We're not computing amplitudes of waves particularly. We're really computing probabilities. And this is just a very funny way of doing that. I will try to answer this first question, which is, why square roots? And I actually will come up with a kind of answer. But the answer is going to make this question worse. Okay, so that means it's not really an answer. And I'll talk about photon polarization to set the stage here. So here's the linearly polarized photon. It just came from this linear polarizing filter. And now we want to measure its polarization, okay? And you know there's no such thing as a device you could stick here that will just tell you that's 42 degrees away from the vertical. No such device. And that's an interesting fact in its own right. We could talk about that for a long time. We typically assign a polarization state to this photon, but there is no way to measure it, okay? What you can do instead is you can make ask a binary question. You say, are you vertical or are you horizontal? Okay, or horizontal is going to go this way, vertically polarized is going to go this way. And the photon's forced to choose between those two options, and it does so with some probability. Okay, so then by measuring many, many photons, we can estimate the probability of vertical, the probability of horizontal, and that gives us some information about the angle. Okay, and all right, and later I'm going to ask you to put yourself in the position of this poor photon, who we think of as having this polarization angle that it would love to convey to us, but it simply can't. It can't tell us. This is the only way. We force it to do these binary, to make these binary decisions. But then if you have many of its friends doing the same thing all together, they can tell us something about the angle. Okay, so here it is. It's gone through there. And that one happened to be vertical, or be measured as vertical. And so by measuring many photons, we can estimate the probability, and that tells us the probability of vertical, that tells us about the angle. Okay, and then the usual way we do this, here is the probability of getting, say, the vertical outcome as a function of the angle from the vertical. It's cosine squared of theta. Okay, certainly that was known in the 19th century, except it wasn't called probability, it would be intensity. Okay, and so here's a probability amplitude. In this case, it's a real number, the real probability of vertical. This is the probability amplitude of vertical. This is the probability amplitude of horizontal. And you square that probability amplitude to get the probability. Okay, so here's what I want to do, is I want to suggest a completely different explanation for that curve. That's in the spirit of trying to explain why we have square roots of probability. I want to suggest a completely different explanation, and the explanation goes like this. Okay, this is an idea that in this talk I haven't mentioned before. Optimal information transfer. Okay, suppose that this is the principle, that the fundamental principle is this, that here comes this photon, it cannot express its polarization in the kind of measurement that we can do on it. Okay. We can give it this binary decision to make, vertical versus horizontal. It makes that decision, but it cannot express this continuous polarization in that decision. You can't express a continuous variable in a binary variable, for one thing. It's also probabilistic, okay? And so that's the conundrum the photon finds itself in. It can't express its polarization given the mechanism that we allow it to use. So does it do the best it can? That's the question, okay? Does it express itself as well as possible given that it has to use this binary probabilistic measurement to express its continuous polarization? Okay, now why would we expect such a principle? There are many ways one might argue this. In classical physics, certainly the future is completely determined by the past. Okay, it's deterministic. So there's this perfect connection between the past and the future. In quantum mechanics, even in the Schrodinger equation, there's a perfect connection between the past and the future. But in measurement in quantum mechanics, there's not, because of this. You just don't have a perfect connection. But is it as good a connection as possible? Is it as good a connection as conceivable, given that there's a probabilistic binary measurement, and that's a continuous variable? Okay, do you get the strongest connection possible? Okay, I mean, conceivably, nature could be arranged that way, and maybe that's why it does what it does. Why is it binary? No, I'm starting with that as a given. Okay, for some reason it's binary. Okay, right, and that's just the way it is. And we'd have to figure that out later. Good question.
So, jump ahead. Does it really matter that it's binary or that it's discrete? Right?
Well,
you can do a similar experiment.
Oh sure. Oh yeah, absolutely. Right.
Discrete,
it's discrete, but I'm particularly focusing on the binary case.
Yeah.
to assume a universe where you can build a beam splitter. And if we assume that these experiments can take place in a universe that allows beam splitters, then we pretty much have to work with the idea of binary.
Right. But right now, I've chosen, the introductory example was interference, you know, a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. But right now I'm thinking about photon polarization. And that is a fundamentally binary variable, right? I mean, the Hilbert space for photon polarization is a two-dimensional vector space. Yeah.
Do we have quantization of angle?
I'm assuming not. I'm assuming it's a continuous angle. Okay. The theta varies continuously. Because you can rotate that polarization filter, that polarizing filter, however you want. So there, we really do have a continuum there. But the measurement is discrete. The measurement forces a binary outcome. Okay, so I'm going to do an analogous experiment here. This, now, there's no physics in the next few slides. This is just a little game, communication puzzle between Alice and Bob, okay? But it's supposed to be analogous to the photon and the measurement, okay? So that Alice is kind of playing the role of the photon in a way. She's going to think of a number, theta. It's a real number between 0 and 90 degrees, okay? It's kind of supposed to be like photon polarization. But it's just a number between 0 and 90 degrees, 0 and pi over 2, really. And then she's going to try to convey that number to Bob. But the rules of the game go like this. The only way we allow her to convey that number, she can't just talk to Bob. What's that?
There are polarizations everywhere between 0 and pi that are...
Oh, yeah. And we could keep going. And we could do this same game for 0 to 2 pi if you want. You're absolutely right. We can. I just did it like this to simplify the argument. But
because the extremes...
Sure, absolutely. We don't cover the whole range by doing that. You go all the way... Right, exactly. So when we finish, we can talk about it. Yeah. So, but in this little game, I'm just having it go from 0 to pi. Anyway, yeah, we can go all the way, but it'll work. The same argument will work.
Yeah, well, this is enough to cover all probabilities.
This covers all the probabilities, exactly. Yeah, that's why it makes the game kind of simple.
Yeah.
But again, Alice's not thinking about polarization right now.
No.
She's thinking about communicating to Bob a number between 0 and pi over 2. And we just make it so that the only way we allow her to communicate is this. She has to construct a coin, okay? Construct a coin that is a biased coin, okay? It has a probability of heads and a probability of tails. It's not necessarily a fair coin. And Alice is an expert, it happens, that Alice is an expert at constructing these biased coins, okay? She can make a coin that has probability of heads equal to 90%, if that's what's called for. She can do that. We give her that. So her deal is she's going to construct a coin. She is going to encode her number theta into the probability of heads of that coin. Then she's going to send that coin to Bob. That's all she sends to Bob is the coin. Now, she and Bob have agreed on the encoding. Okay, they know what the connection is between theta and the probability of heads. They've agreed on that. And then Bob is going to toss the coin. Okay, let's see. So. Okay, she sends the coin to Bob. To find theta, Bob will flip the coin, okay? Okay, in that way, he can try to estimate the probability of heads. And then, since he knows the encoding, he can change the probability of heads into a value of theta. And he learns about theta. Okay, that's the game. Except, for right now, we're making it a very hard game for this pass through. We'll make it better later. But for this pass, we're making it extremely hard on Alice and Bob because this coin self-destructs after one flip. Okay? All right? All right. But nevertheless, that's the game we're assigning to these guys. And Alice and Bob have to come up with what's the optimal encoding for sending information if this is what you've got to work with. You're going to encode in a coin, send the coin to Bob, toss it, he tosses it once, that's it. He finds out whether it's heads or tails, and that's the end. And now he has to estimate theta as well as possible. Okay? It's not easy. He's not going to get very much information.
So, bad guy, but if you'll be doing that, you'll be quantization of angles. So because you should be able
to. Yeah. Very, very good. Yes. So, okay. But keep stay with me. Okay. We're going to give him more tosses later.
Yeah.
Okay. And now I do have to tell you, what's our measure of success here? Well, our measure of success is the mutual information between the number of heads that Bob sees. In this simple example, that number is going to be either zero heads or one head, because he only gets one toss. The mutual information between that discrete thing and this continuous variable theta, which is Alice's theta. And we do assume that theta is initially distributed uniformly between 0 and pi over 2. Okay, so uniformly distributed over the interval. This p of theta is the probability distribution for theta initially. It's that uniform distribution. This p of theta given n is the probability distribution that Bob assigns to theta once he has seen the outcome to be 0 or to be 1. Okay, and we average that over the possible outcomes at 0 and 1. And so this is basically how much information Bob lacks initially about theta, and this is how much information he lacks at the end about theta on average after he's tossed the coin. So the difference is how much information he has gained about theta by tossing the coin on average. I mean, you might get more information from a zero than a zero heads than from a one head, so that's why I have to average. Okay, so that's just our figure of merit. And now it's a well-defined mathematical problem to figure out what kind of encoding of theta into probability will give them the optimal amount of information. We'll give Bob as much information as possible. And the answer is, this is an optimal encoding. Very discrete looking. Okay, here's Alice's number, and this is the probability of heads that Alice assigns to any given number. So it's saying that if the number is in this between 0 and pi over 4, Alice will construct a coin that lands only heads. It lands heads every single time. And if the if Alice's number is between pi over 4 and pi over 2, she will construct a coin that only lands tails. Okay? And so Bob is going to get this coin. He's going to flip it once. Bang, it lands heads. And he has learned that Alice's number is between 0 and pi over 4. It's in this range. That counts as one bit of information. He's reduced the range from here to here, from here to here. And so, and that is the very best he can do, and that's not surprising. It's not surprising. He could not do better in just one toss. You can't learn more than one bit of information with tossing a coin just once. Okay, now we'll make the problem more interesting. We're going to give Bob two tosses, two flips of the coin. Okay, but once again, there is going to be some optimal strategy for conveying the information, and I'll just show you. So he tosses it two times, and then it self-destructs. So now he can get zero, he can get heads, he can get heads-tails, he can get tails-heads, or he can get tails-tails. And now here is here is an optimal encoding for Alice and Bob. Looks like this. Okay? So there's this, now there's this region where Alice constructs a coin that's a fair coin, has probably one half, okay, probably one half of landing heads. So it turns out to be useful to use that kind of coin now that Bob has two tosses. Because now if he gets a head and a tail, okay, if he gets a head and a tail in his two tosses, he knows that you're in this region, right? Because it would be impossible to get a head and a tail if you have a coin that only lands heads or a coin that only lands tails. Okay, so he gains some information. Yes, Arjuna.
How large is the region?
What's that?
How large is the region?
How large are the region? Oh, you really want to know that? Okay. I thought someone might ask that question. So this range here is 15/34 of the whole range. This is also 15/34, and this is 4/34. Sorry?
You say unoptimal encoding. Is it not unique?
An optimal. It is not unique. Not unique. And it's easy to see it's not unique. You could take these guys and interchange them in different ways. Like I could put this part over here and put this part over here. It really doesn't matter for information. It's only a question of by how much do you reduce the range.
But it's isomorphous. It's not like you can change the width of the shelf or something.
Imagine slicing this up into vertical slices. Take this function, slice it up into vertical slices, and then rearrange the slices. It's just as good.
But there's always a region of the part that's one is always the same.
Exactly. There's always 15/34 of it is sitting up there with probability 1. Yeah. Yes?
There's some underlying physical reason why it's 34.
No, it's mathematical. It just comes from, taking derivatives of logarithm stuff. It happens to come out rational numbers. As soon as we give him 3 tosses instead of 2 tosses, it's not rational anymore. Okay, I'm not going directly to 3 tosses. Yes?
Is this going to be the same coin after the first toss?
He gets the coin, and he tosses that coin twice. The very same coin, he tosses twice. And Alice has constructed the coin either, in this case, either to be such that it always lands heads, or that it always lands tails, or it's a fair coin. So once he tosses it twice, he has a pretty good idea which of those 3 classes it's in.
But you say it's a fair coin, it means that if it was heads the first time, it will definitely be tails.
Oh, no. We don't know that. If he gets heads and then tails, he knows it was the fair coin. If he gets 2 heads, he guesses it's more likely to be the coin that only lands heads, but it could still be the fair coin, because a fair coin can land 2 heads. So if he gets 2 heads, he doesn't know if he's in this region or in this region, but he assigns more weight to this region.
It's
all probabilistic. His knowledge is probabilistic. And information theory is really good for handling probabilistic knowledge, so that's why I'm using that measure.
But it wasn't the case in the previous
It was, yeah, exactly. Before that, it was deterministic knowledge. He knew for a fact that it's in this region. This is no longer the case. Okay. I'm not going to go. You think I'm going to go to 3 tosses now? But no, I'm going to go to 25 tosses. 25 flips. Okay. Here is an optimal curve for 25 flips. Okay. All right, that's just what the computer gives you. Okay, you work it out on the computer. That optimizes the mutual information between the number of heads that Bob sees in his 25 tosses and the value of theta that Alice is trying to convey. Okay, this is if Alice encodes her information in this way, encodes theta in this way in the probability, she will convey as much information as possible to Bob about theta. Okay, and now, yes.
That's 8 steps.
Yeah, for 25.
You can still shuffle the 8?
And you can shuffle. You could shuffle. Right, exactly. You could shuffle them.
Can you shuffle a cosine square function?
Yeah, right, exactly. So you see, this relates to your earlier question. If you take a cosine squared thing, you could shuffle it, and it'll just be cosine squared over a different interval. I mean, for example, that's one way of doing the shuffling. That's a real infinitesimal kind of shuffling. All right, so now, I've done enough finite cases. So now, okay, enough of this discrete angle stuff. We're going to say, let's take the limit of an infinite number of flips. Well, in an infinite number, if Bob has a coin that he can flip an infinite number of times, he can actually get an infinite amount of information, because we're talking about a continuum of values of theta, right? And so there's no limit to the amount of information. There's an infinite amount of information to be had. And Bob could get arbitrarily much information by tossing coin over and over and over again. So what we do is, rather than maximizing the information itself, we maximize this limit where you take the information, mutual information between theta and n, and subtract the log of the square root of n. The amount of information Bob gains grows as the logarithm of the square root of n. That square root comes from the ordinary statistical fluctuations, which are of order square root of the number of tosses. That's where that square root comes from. The log comes from just information theory. Information theory is kind of log of the uncertainty, minus log of the uncertainty, that kind of thing. So that's where that's coming from. So if you subtract off this part, this difference remains finite as you go to an infinite number of tosses. So it makes perfect sense to maximize that, okay? And we're gonna say, what encodings maximize that limit? Okay, well, here is an encoding that maximizes that, okay? It is cosine squared of theta, okay? And the punchline of this talk is right here. This is what photons do, okay? So maybe we have explained why photons do this, but we have explained it in a way that does not invoke probability amplitudes. This explanation comes from just analyzing probabilities and the binomial distribution and from some information theory. So it's a completely different way of getting that curve. So yes.
And I'm sorry to come back to this again, but in the same limit, you can reshuffle this.
Yes.
An infinite number of different
yes,
ways.
Yes, that's true. You're right.
It wouldn't look like a cosine.
Wouldn't like that. Yeah, but suppose you insist that it be a continuous function. Then that's gonna limit what you get. But you're right. You could reshuffle this, and you could make it look like this. Okay, cosine squared, but with a different frequency, different period.
But I have to put continuity in.
Yeah, you'd have to do that. You could also, to be honest, you can also get other funny things. Like it looks cosines. You can make cosine squared here with a certain wavelength, and then cosine squared with a different wavelength coming back up. Okay, so you could do that. Yes, there are many ways you can do it. But still the point is, what nature does is optimal, okay? It's not the only optimal thing, but it's optimal, and maybe with some other assumptions we could sort of uniquely pin down this guy. Yeah, Alex?
So what you're saying is, we could have gotten this by just imposing a classical limit.
Yeah.
What you're saying is that the result you get from imposing a classical limit, since we know how to solve the wave equation for beam splitters, is equivalent to assuming that we maximize mutual information and impose some continuity assumptions.
Something like that. I mean, that would be a pretty cool thing, especially if you could get all of quantum mechanics in that way. All right, my aim is high. Okay, I don't just aim to understand photons. I don't aim to understand photon polarization. I want to get, where the heck does the structure of quantum theory come from? Okay, that's the ambitious aim here. Okay, so it'd be great if you could do it. Okay, and let me just tell you why this works, because it may not be obvious, and I don't expect it to be obvious at all. What's so special about cosine squared that makes this work in this setting? Here's what's so special about it. It is a fact. This is a fact about the binomial distribution. I've already talked 30 minutes, I'm afraid. But there have been interruptions, so I can keep going. Okay, so it's a fact about the binomial distribution that the spread in the frequencies of occurrence, say of heads, the spread, like you toss a coin 100 times, okay, toss a fair coin 100 times, then you're going to get about 50 heads, plus or minus something or other, okay? But now you toss a biased coin 100 times, a really biased coin that mostly lands tails. You're going to get 10 heads, plus or minus one or two, okay? The fluctuations are very small at the ends of probability space, very large in the middle. That's simply a fact. You can just, it works it out, working out mathematically. So I've indicated that here. In the middle of the range of probabilities, the fluctuations are large, statistical fluctuations are large. Near the edge, near the ends, they are smaller. And it happens that this cosine squared curve is such that the slope is small in this part, the slope is bigger here, and the effect is that the uncertainty in theta, in Alice's number theta, is the same here as it is here. There's this perfect match between the size of the statistical fluctuations and the slope of cosine squared. You can see that match here. If you take derivative of cosine squared of theta, you get negative 2 cosine theta sine theta. But that's the square root of cosine squared times sine squared. So that's there's two mathematical facts that match up with each other that make it work. And I can explain this in other ways too, or just picture it in other ways. Here's this probability, here are the probabilities of the two outcomes, heads and tails. Here's the range of possible points in probability space. And here's this statistical spread being larger in the middle of the space than at the edge. But if you simply reparameterize probability space with square roots of probability, those spreads are the same size. Okay, that's another way of saying the same thing. And this works in higher dimensions too. Suppose you have a three-sided coin or three-sided die, okay, and you have probabilities 1, 2, and 3. Here's ordinary probability space. Here's the size and shapes of the statistical fluctuations after you've tossed the thing 100 times, say. But if you represent it in terms of square roots of probability, the sizes and shapes of statistical probability of statistical spreads are the same. They're all little circles, and they're all the same size. Okay, and this is a well-known fact in certain circles. Okay, here's a paper from genetics. It's not hard to find this kind of diagram in genetics, in the genetics literature, where people use square roots of probability because it's so convenient for dealing with things like genetic drift or something. You know, if you're trying to see how does a population move around in probability space, it's easier to think about in terms of square roots of probability. So if we're asking why does nature use square roots of probability in quantum mechanics, maybe nature has something like this in mind. Okay, this is what I'm kind of suggesting. Okay, so isn't this a great story? So in quantum theory, it's impossible to have a perfect correspondence between the past and future because of measurement, this probabilistic measurements, discrete measurements. But the correspondence is as close as possible. The information transfer is optimal, given the limitations of this probabilistic measurement with discrete outcomes. Okay, okay, and maybe this begins to explain why we have to use square roots of probability. Isn't that a nice story? I won't have a show of hands to see how many people think it's a nice story. I simply assert that it's a nice story. But the fact is, oh yes.
By show of hands. So far you're looking at the probabilities and the square root of probabilities. So how do complex numbers come?
Great, perfect segue. Yes, perfect question. The story is not true. Okay, this wonderful story, which I've built up, it's just not true because probability amplitudes are complex. This has been bugging me for decades, literally decades. Why did nature choose to have complex probability amplitudes? And you can see it doesn't work because, okay, now I'm going to talk about, here's photon polarization. Yeah, I've talked about the linear polarizations, but that's not the whole set of polarizations. There are also circular and elliptical polarizations, and the set of all pure polarization states of a photon lies on a sphere, okay? And if you just make measurements of vertical versus horizontal, as far as information transfer is concerned, it's not very satisfying because there's this whole degree of freedom that you're not capturing at all. That Alice isn't conveying to Bob at all, if you will. The photons aren't even bothering to tell you about the phase between vertical and horizontal if you're measuring vertical and versus horizontal. So there's this whole thing that you're not capturing at all. And also, even from the perspective of information theory and the a priori measure on the space, I assumed it was crucial, but I assumed that theta was uniformly distributed. Okay, which made sense if you're only talking about linear polarizations. You just, you know, that's the natural measure to take on the circle of linear polarizations. But on the sphere of polarizations, the natural measure is the uniform measure on the sphere. Okay, that's the one that's invariant under rotations of the sphere, which correspond to unitary transformations. So, but if you take that as your a priori distribution, you don't get maximum information transfer. It just doesn't work. It is true that you get a cosine squared. The probability of vertical is the cosine squared of this gamma over 2. And that's a fine kind of cosine squared thing. But gamma, the polar angle here, is not uniformly distributed a priori. So therefore, the assumption of my game doesn't apply. And information is not transferred optimally. Okay? Isn't that too bad? Okay, now I've talked for too long, right? No? Okay, I just have a few.
A couple minutes, maybe a 10.
I'll take two more minutes.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, or to put it in other words, this picture might suggest real square roots of probability, but it doesn't suggest complex square roots of probability, right? Nothing about that suggests complex. Okay, I do have a little another way of trying to formulate the question that I worked on recently, that where it's really quantum mechanics. We really get the whole shebang, the complex stuff and everything. It's entangled. You start with an entangled state. You make a four-outcome entangled measurement at the end, and you have a unitary transformation on one of the particles in between. And now the goal is conveying information about this transformation through the probabilities of the outcomes of the measurement. That actually does work. It does convey information optimally, but that doesn't, frustratingly, does not generalize to higher dimensional things like spin one or something like that. So that's frustrating. So now I just thought I'd end, okay, in one last minute, just to say what kinds of answers are out there, because I'm not the only one who's thought about this question, why complex amplitudes? And here are some of the answers that I'm most familiar with. My guess is that there are quite a few other answers out there that are not on this list. Answers that people have given for why is nature constructed in this way with complex probability amplitudes? Well, Stueckelberg in 1960 argued it's because you want to have an uncertainty principle of a particular form. And you couldn't do that if the amplitudes were real. Okay, that was his argument. In the quantum information community, there is almost a consensus on what the answer to this question is. It is that you want local tomography. It's a quantum information kind of thing, which is to say this. If you have, say, a pair of quantum systems that are created together and go off like this, go off in different directions, and you're trying to figure out what's the state of the pair, well, you can do it by making local measurements on the two individual particles, okay? And paying a and you have many pairs created in the same way, you just keep track of the statistics. And it turns out that local statistics, okay, but keeping track of the correlations between this side and this side are enough to reconstruct the state of the pair. And if probability amplitudes were real, you could not do that. Okay, that's an interesting fact. If probability amplitudes were real, it's easy to find examples where no matter what measurements you make on... Ted, you were around when we talked about this 30 years ago. No matter what measurements you make on the local particles, you can't, there's some information about the pair that you simply can't access that way. The only way you could access that information would be to bring the two particles together and make a joint measurement on them like that. So there's no, you can't locally ascertain the state of the pair. Okay. So in many reconstructions of quantum theory, axiomatic reconstructions, they simply assume you have local tomography. They make that assumption so that they can rule out real amplitude quantum theory. That's the only reason they make that assumption. Okay, then there are other ideas. You want some kind of complementarity of a particular kind that maybe gives you the complex stuff. Many people you talk to say, oh, well, nature, of course, is going to choose the complex numbers because the complex numbers are algebraically closed. Okay, any polynomial with complex coefficients has complex roots. I mean, you can find all the roots. The reals you can't do that with. Okay, some people think that's the reason. Now, I and some students have recently said, oh, well, maybe you have complex numbers because actually the world is actually real. Real amplitudes, that's the way the world really acts. But it looks complex because there's this thing called the U-bit. If anyone wants to ask me about that, I'd be happy to tell you about that. Okay, so I think the conclusion is, we don't know this. We don't know why nature, I'm not sold on this. We don't know why nature likes complex probability amplitudes. And again, some people would say, yeah, that's because there is no answer to that question. But I still think, my own view is, there is an answer, we just haven't found it yet. And someday we're going to have some deeper understanding of quantum theory, and we're going to see, ah, that's what's going on. Okay, we don't have it yet though. Okay, thanks a lot. Yeah. What's the physics connection? Yeah, that's the thing that bothers me about this. I don't buy a purely mathematical argument. It seems like there has to be some kind of connection with physics.
Is there some physics you get out of having roots of arbitrary
quantum? Well, yeah, so Scott Aronson has mentioned one example. So, say, for any transformation you do, you would also like to be able to do the square root of that transformation. That is, you'd like to be able to go halfway, okay? Well, there's some transformation, some matrices you can write down, orthogonal matrices for a real amplitude quantum theory that don't have square roots because you can't take the square root of -1, for example. Okay, but it turns out, nevertheless, you can define a kind of square root even for that. You just have to bring in another particle as an ancilla, and then you actually can do a square root. So I'm not sure that that's a very airtight argument.
How is quantization affected by all of this? I mean, you know, whenever we talk about going from classical to quantum, you do x, comma, p, I, h bar.
Yeah.
And I is very, very
Very good. Well, that's kind of the Stueckelberg thing, that he's looking for some analog in the real amplitude theory of delta x, delta p is, you know, proportional to I times the commutator between x and p, or more general for general variables. And he argues that you really can't do that very well in the real theory. And so that's why we have complex stuff. Yeah, and there's a lot, but then you could imagine, you could ask, though, what if we lived in a world that didn't have momentum, okay? I mean, we could, so if we had, say, you know, we have a real amplitude quantum theory, with a perfectly consistent theory, and doesn't have momentum as we know it, or something.
Yeah, but I was going to say that, you know, when we learn to solve differential equations, there's a trick that they show you, make cosines into complexes, because they're easy to multiply out.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's some kind of a mathematical operation which are happening behind everything, this measurement process.
Yeah.
So is it possible that the world may be real, but the nature just makes it complex because it can do the calculation?
Oh, great. That's an interesting question. That nature, that it's fundamentally real, but nature herself or himself or itself has already sort of helped us to do calculations by sort of going to the complex numbers where the calculations were easier.
This argument is closure argument.
Closure, right. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's related to the algebraic closure.
When you showed me that sphere, remind me of the Pontryagin phase or Berry phase.
Oh, remind you of the Berry phase. Yeah, yeah.
Theta, phi, and you know, in electrons, you take them around.
Yep.
There's Berry phase information contains behind. When you talk about this real world interpretation, I'm just curious what the Berry phase physics interpretation would be.
Well, that's interesting. Now, that is interesting. So if you have, but if you have, say, a binary thing like spin or something, and you bring it around a loop, and then you can have a Berry phase, right? And it depends on the area of the loop that you brought around.
The angle that it picks up.
Yeah, right, the solid angle, right. And if you had, say, a binary thing in real amplitude quantum theory, instead of having a sphere, you'd have a circle. And so there is no area. So you go around and then you come back and there's no area. So there would be no Berry phase for that. But there would be a Berry phase, presumably, for something in three dimensions. A real thing in three dimensions could do that, or any higher dimension. So I could live in a world that didn't have Berry phase for two-dimensional things. It seems like, yeah.
What about, instead of sort of algebraic closure, some kind of group connectedness thing?
Oh.
U1. Rather than R, right?
Uh-huh.
You don't have to go through zero, you kind of go around.
Yeah, 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 right, right. Yeah, and that's related to kind of the square root argument or something. There may be something like that. I mean, maybe that is what nature is thinking, something like that. But I'm, I mean, my gut feeling is to look for something kind of, first of all, I like discreteness, I like counting things, and I would love to see some kind of counting argument that would give us this, you know.
Well, so there are people who've thought about, who have thought about what if you go up to
quaternions,
right? I mean, so
yeah.
People who try to go take the closure argument
yeah.
to even more extreme
yeah.
cases. What is the status of that?
That's
are
great.
Are there people who will...
There are people who still work on that. Stephen Adler wrote a whole book on quaternionic quantum theory. Finkelstein is one of the first to talk about that.
And has that, right, because I mean, has that given us any insight into this problem? Because if we have even more general...
It's a good question. There is a little bit of an ambiguity in the quaternionic quantum mechanics when you do composite systems. When you make a composite, so in ordinary quantum theory, you make a composite by doing a tensor product, okay? Suppose you've got three things, you just tensor product them together. But with quaternions, multiplication is not commutative, and so the tensor product is problematic, and so you have to choose some way of combining systems. Here's how I'm going to do it. You have to make a choice. And it's not clear that there's a natural choice.
When I think about what complex numbers enable us to do, if I've tried to time evolve a classical wave, the only way to change the phase of that wave is also to change the instantaneous magnitude
yes.
of the electric or magnetic field.
Yes.
Get an additional set of transformations. So I don't know that I can state some principle of, oh, the universe wants to do this, but what I think what complex numbers are probably telling us is not something about algebraic closure, but that the nature of the universe is such that a wave can be time evolved without changing one of its other variables.
Yeah, exactly. And this is related, I think, to, like, you can have, say, a state of a momentum eigenstate, okay? De Broglie says, okay, the momentum is related to the wavelength. Okay, so the young students, sophomores, first year students, are immediately imagining this kind of thing, and you have a different wavelength, you have a different thing. But with the complex numbers, you can have this kind of thing. You know, this is the phase in the complex plane. So the amplitude never has to vary, and nevertheless you have the concept of a wavelength. And I think it's related to what you're talking about. So there are some kind of cool things that happen when you have complex numbers. You can do this kind of stuff. As you say, with time, you can time evolve the thing without changing any amplitude, without changing any magnitudes
yeah.
of the amplitudes and the energy basis, right? They all stay the same. But the phases change, and that's what the evolution is about. Yeah. So it would be a different world. It would be a different world if we lived in a real... it would feel different, but why don't we live in that world? I mean,
So I attempt to teach quantum mechanics to freshmen.
Yeah.
And
we do too.
Yeah, that's good. Now we're talking. We're starting a movement. And my course. Predates the transformation of quantum mechanical theory into quantum information theory.
Uh-huh.
So I don't tell an information story
uh-huh.
at all.
Uh-huh.
But I somehow get them to believe that if you superpose two things, physically that's just bringing two beams
mm-hmm.
on top of each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that the logical thing to represent that is addition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then the algebra of addition for spinning particles doesn't work even when you have only two dimensions of the spin, unless you use the square root.
Ah.
Because the unitarity is violated. It's similar. It's not an information theory.
I get
similar
it.
Similar to your story of the Mach Zender.
I get it.
And
yeah.
The square root.
Right. Uh huh.
Okay. And then, without Poincaré spheres.
Uh-huh.
It's a real life sphere. So you've described everything in the X, Z spin
direction
with the real numbers, and it exhausts all of the possibilities. When you introduce the Y direction, you still need something that's 50-50, and you get it by introducing I.
So uh-huh.
The complex numbers from having three dimensions in space. But we started with an algebraic representation anticipating Heisenberg's matrix.
And that argument could go either way. You could say we have complex amplitudes in quantum mechanics because we live in three-dimensional world. Or you could say we live in a three-dimensional world
now
because...
Let's see if we can't get this sort of old wives' tale that I teach the freshmen more rigorously out of discreteness, out of the same discreteness you started with, that each coin gives only half
right.
tails, each photon only answers binary questions.
Yeah, that's a brand new idea to the discussion.
Yeah, that's what I was asking you. Is it one of these, or it doesn't?
No. I didn't list that. I didn't list that.
Complex because we live in a.
Because we live in three dimensions. Yeah.
You did that to spin one half of dimension.
Yeah, you do spin half so that you have.
What happens if you have a d-dimensional world? You look at the analogs and representations, the d-dimension. It might not actually be unique in three dimensions.
There's a good chance. That the spinner representation also works for
right.
any number of dimensions.
Right.
But what the hell? These are freshmen. They live in three dimensions. Why screw up?
Because quantum mechanics doesn't just work in three dimensions, right? You get one dimension.
No. That's fine because after a little while.
So it better not be that.
After a little while, looking at movies of Stern Gerlach machines, they see that spin is just a counting number for how many beams come out, where 2s plus 1 is the beam. So it's really just So they're ready for multi-dimensional quantum and for your product book. Outer product.
Just a side comment. For your cosine square thing, the condition that pulls it out is monotonicity.
Absolutely. If we make it, if we say it's monotonic from 0 to pi over 2, we got it.
Yeah.
It's then you can't rearrange anything. Yeah, right. But then Herb will say, but you're why pi over 2? You know.
Well, so you repick this.
Yeah, okay, right.
No, why pi over 2 when there are actually 180 distinct.
Yeah, exactly.
But, if
you're just.
Like monotonicity.
But we could get this, yeah.
You want to have fine. So you're pegging it that's got to be, you know, 1 here, 0 here, and 1 there.
Yeah.
No problem.
You could even do that.
The difficulty is you're in a spin 1 situation. If you go to spin half, factor of 2 comes out.
Well, that's true. If you're doing spin half, you could have 0 to pi and have it be monotonic. Yeah, right. Well, this may be a good stopping place.
Okay.
What?